Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The New Statesman.
The longer the Conservatives hang on, the worse it gets. Last week, Rishi Sunak lost 474 councillors, Blackpool South, and Andy Street's West Midlands mayoralty. And yesterday, things went from bad to worse for Sunak, with a surprised defection to Labour from Natalie Elphick, MP for Dover and Deal. The Conservatives can't seem to escape this endless decline in support and popularity. So when did it all start to go wrong? And can they stop the train before it completely derails? Hello, I'm Freddie Hayward, political correspondent at The New Statesman, and you're listening to The New Statesman podcast. I'm very pleased to be joined today by my colleagues Rachel Cunliffe, Associate Political Editor, and George Eaton, Senior Editor. Rachel, you've written this week's cover story, The Tory Doom Scroll, which goes inside the party's woes in the aftermath of the locals. Tell us about it. What did you find?
So it's sort of a reaction to the local election results and how the party is responding, but I've tried to chat to people, not just about that set of election results, but like how they're feeling and what they think is going to come next. And one of the things that really stood out to me is there isn't really any sense of hope at the moment. There's no kind of sense of maybe we could just, you know, that was it, steep and narrow path to victory that Isaac Levido talks about. There's no sense of that whatsoever. They are completely and utterly resigned to the fact that they are going to lose and lose quite significantly. But at the same time, they don't think there's anything they can do about it. There was a lot of chatter in the month leading up to the local elections about if this was a really bad result, would we see a renewed effort to get rid of Rishi Sunak, the plotters, what would they do? What would their game plan be? And it was a really bad result for Rishi Sunak. They clung on to Ben Houchen, but that was it.
Ben Houchen in Tees Valley.
In Tees Valley and by a dramatically reduced margin. And they lost Andy Street and they lost the by-election in Blackpool South by a really significant swing. And nothing. No sense of, okay, now we're going to move against him. Just, this is it now. And it was described to me by someone in the party as a train crash. The train is on the rails. You can see it coming, but you can't do anything to reverse it. You just have to watch it happening. And I found that really interesting that there is this sort of simultaneously an awareness of how badly things are going, but no momentum to do anything that might change it. They got to the acceptance stage of grief, I would say, before the election has even happened.
And George, Andy Street, he's a huge Tory figure. Many people in Parliament respect him, respect his independence, and I think he's been quite critical of the government in the past. Remember him doing that quite assertive, direct press conference at Tory Party conference with all the journalists around him when Rishi Sunak announced the cancellation of HS2. I mean, what does his loss mean? Is it a big blow for the party? How do you see it?
It's a big blow for two reasons, I think. First, as you say, Street was one of the actually a few senior Conservative figures at the moment who attracts that sort of cross-party respectability. The West Midlands has been absolutely pivotal to the Conservatives' advance over recent elections. And you know, as Rachel explores in her piece, you know, Number 10 made keeping the West Midlands, keeping Street, sort of totemic for them That was their expectation management. And they ended up losing by only 1,500 votes. But in politics, it's the margins that matter. And that gave Labour something to celebrate right at the end of the run of results. And had the Conservatives hung on to that, I think the narrative would be a bit different this week. Mm. Albeit that, you know, one election doesn't change the overall appalling picture for the Tories.
And Rachel, just because they lost Andy Street seems to have taken the legs out of this plot, right? But was it ever something that could succeed? It seemed to me to always be quite nebulous, quite amorphous. It was hard to know how many MPs were supporting them. I mean, was that realistic? It seems to me that many MPs took the slightly more rational perspective and said, well, if we get rid of another Prime Minister, people will just think we look even more ridiculous. And there was no one sort of proposing a radical change from what Rishi Sunak's doing, which could have maybe helped them in the polls. How do you see it?
I think Ben Wallace really summarised that feeling.
Yeah.
I think it was about 2 months ago he was asked about this and he essentially said, and I'm paraphrasing here, Rishi Sunak is absolutely rubbish. Getting rid of him now and replacing him with somebody else would be even worse and make us look more chaotic. So I think maybe there was momentum around it in January. That's obviously when Simon Clark went public and said that Rishi Sunak should go. The row over the Rwanda bill, or it was tough enough or not, there was a lot of bad feeling in the party that looked like it might coalesce around something. But having missed that opportunity, I think even the people who really don't want Sunak to lead them into the next election have kind of accepted that they don't really have a choice now. And that, strangely, protects him in a way, because that decision has been made that it's too late. But it also gives him, I think, the misguided idea that because he's no longer facing a leadership threat in quite that way, he can just limp on and wait for something to come up. So there's been a lot of speculation about the local results, getting Rwanda through, would there be a summer election? It was suggested that there might be, and then it was briefed that had been called off. I don't think a summer election was ever planned. I don't think there was ever any kind of strategy that this is what they were going to do. But I think nobody wants there to be an election right at the end of the year when it looks like they're desperate and just sort of running out of time. December, January, cold weather, short days, etc., etc. But if at every point when there could be an election, there's a reason not to have it, i.e. the polls are awful, the default will be they limp on. And the conflict between Sunak, who is in charge of deciding to call an election, and the MPs is that Sunak knows he's going to lose. He's the Prime Minister or he's not Prime Minister. Yeah. That's binary. So he has an incentive to leave it as long as possible in the hope that something might come up. His MPs have an incentive to perhaps hold it earlier, get the defeat out of the way, and have it be slightly less bad than it would be if he left it to the last possible moment. So I think they would quite like it to be sooner, cut your losses, appreciate that you're going to lose and maybe lose by a smaller margin rather than have it at the last possible moment. He obviously has an incentive to wait in the hope that something miraculous might come up, even though it's very hard to think now about what that thing might be.
There's a great line in your piece about why the Conservatives should be wary of the right-wing entertainment complex. I mean, tell us about that. Why? What effect has that had, do you think?
So this is a line from Paul Goodman, who was editor of Conservative Home for almost 10 years until very recently and has just become a peer. So you're going to be hearing, I think, a lot more of him in years to come. The line, the right-wing entertainment complex, was, I think, coined by an American conservative, David Frum, about the Republican Party in 2012, just becoming obsessed by Fox News and playing to the Fox News audience, the Fox News presenters, and really politics as entertainment, that kind of rush of endorphins when you say something very controversial and you get a lot of sort of attention for that. And a number of figures in the Conservative Party are a bit worried about GB News in that sense, because it is a space where conservatives, people on the right, really get rewarded for saying quite provocative things. And there can be benefits in that. And we can talk, we have talked the other episodes about what GB News is and it isn't, and the benefits that it may or may not have. But if you're speaking to an audience of GB News viewers, or even more specifically, an audience of GB News presenters, you're not speaking to the country as a whole, and you can end up having debates about being tougher and being more robust and more radical when what the election results are showing you is that the country is actually more in the centre and is quite put off by those conversations.
After the break, we'll be discussing why Natalie Elphick defected. If you're subscribed to The New Statesman, you can get all our episodes ad-free on the New Statesman app. You can get it on both iOS and Android. Just search for New Statesman on the App Store or Google Play Store. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
So we didn't have this plot, this coup against Rishi Sunak that some thought might come. He had a slightly better week. There was some good news for him around Rwanda. That seems to be moving forwards in some respect. But then we had this defection, George, on just before PMQs on Wednesday from Natalie Elphick, who you could say is on the right of the Conservative Party. She's very supportive of the Rwanda scheme, and she's criticised Labour for supporting open borders, as she put it. I mean, is it good for Labour that this has happened? Why do you think they accepted her?
I think they accepted her for ruthless political logic, which is that although it's unsettled some Labour MPs, some people in the shadow cabinet because of her views and past conduct, what are most voters going to see? They're going to see Labour has captured another Conservative defector. And that's key for Labour. Look, it wants to win over Conservative voters, perhaps more than anyone else, because they're worth twice as much in that they boost your vote and reduce the governing party's vote. So that helps you get over the line as the largest party, and then build that majority. And their conclusion will be, well, if Conservative MPs are going over to Labour, they'll think, well, maybe I should give them a look. Clearly, they are really building a broad church here. There's a message, obviously, that, say, some of the voters who've been attracted to the Greens or other parties might take, which is that, hang on, if Labour's attracting Conservative MPs, what does that mean about their policy platform now? But for the reasons I've set out, I think Labour will be very happy that they've got another Tory defector.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the overarching impression that voters will have is that you've got Tory chaos. He can't even keep a grip of his own MPs, and they're attracted to Keir Starmer's Labour Party because it's changed since 2019. David Gawk's got a good line in his column this week about the Greens and about Labour, because I think this is one of the most important sort of trends and stories that we've seen in the aftermath of the local elections. About the fact that Keir Starmer has been so focused on trying to win over the 2019 Conservative voters that he's neglected the Jeremy Corbyn 2017 coalition. And as you said, George, that's fine because he's fighting against the 2019 electoral map. But there's a subtext here, isn't there? There's this growing discontentment amongst some of the left progressive vote in Labour and also some of their voters. And also you've got the pro-Palestinian voice that we saw also mean that many independents did much better than expected in the local election. So I agree, it's not going to mean that they don't get a majority, and it's not the overarching political narrative at the moment, but it's a subtext that we could see develop and emerge as a problem for Labour further down the line.
Absolutely. I think Labour probably has cause to be grateful that the Greens aren't doing better than they are.
Yeah.
I think part of the problem is that they've got two leaders, perhaps confusingly to some, Carla Denyer and Adrian Ramsey. In a recent piece I wrote on the Greens, I cited polling by Ipsos, which showed that a fictional, made-up politician had greater name recognition than them. So I think, you know, if the Greens had a nationally known leader, if they had more momentum, I think Labour would have more to fear. I should point out, when I interviewed Carla Denyer and put this point to her, she said, well, look, that just shows the media aren't covering us enough. Look at how much coverage Reform UK get when they've got, you know, far fewer councillors than us.
Sure, but part of the reason that people cover reform is because they've got a single leader and they inject themselves into the political narrative. And also they have, even though it's quite shallow, they have a more coherent policy platform. The problem with the Greens is that they attract this sort of basket of people who are resentful, and they're looking for an outlet, either because, you know, they're NIMBYs, or they're environmentalists, or they don't like Keir Starmer, or whatever it might be. In a way that the UKIP used to do when it was, you know, when it was rising in the noughties. So the problem, therefore, is that Labour is very much focusing on people like Natalie Elphick and winning over that right wing vote. I mean, what do you think, Rachel? Where does that leave Labour and her?
Well, I just want to go back to the moment when she did cross the floor, because that was quite astonishing. I was in the chamber for PMQs, and I'm going to admit that I missed the moment when she didn't cross the floor in a dramatic way. She just kind of came in and sat down. And if you can't identify every MP by the back of their heads, then you don't always spot them. And then Keir Starmer started PMQs by welcoming his new MP for Blackpool South, who won in the by-election last week. Great, everyone was expecting that. And then said, and I also would like to welcome the MP, the member for Dover, to the Labour benches. And you just had everyone in the press gallery and quite a lot of MPs on both benches going, wait, what? Because this was not expected. No. It was not... if you'd had to say, which Tory MP do you think is most likely to defect? You would never say Natalie Elphick. I think Steve Baker, the Northern Ireland minister, was quite playful on Twitter when he said that he'd been asking colleagues and none of them could think of anyone who was to the right of Natalie Elphick in the party. Now, obviously, her constituency is Dover. Yeah. The issue of channel crossings is particularly significant there. And that's something that she talked about in her defection statement about how Rishi Sunak had failed to keep the borders safe and secure. And, you know, George is right that as messaging goes, saying we don't trust, even the Conservatives don't trust Rishi Sunak on this particular issue, she's come to Labour. Like that's quite a symbolic win. She's quite controversial, though, for other reasons. Even if you sort of put aside her, the comments she's made on immigration and the refugee crisis, right? I don't think we should put those aside, but put those aside for a minute. I'm getting quite a lot of messages from people within the Westminster world from all parties who are a bit concerned about some of the comments that she's made on sexual assaults and victims of sexual misconduct, because she is the MP for Dover. She replaced her husband, who was the Conservative MP for Dover, Charlie Elphick, who was firstly suspended from Parliament when there were allegations made against him of sexual assault, and was then convicted and sentenced to 2 years for those crimes. And her reaction to that was not just to stand by him in a sort of personal level, but she kind of went after the victims, and even after he'd been convicted, made a lot of comments that really play to some of the very tired and I think damaging stereotypes about these sorts of cases, about he was just an attractive man, and really made some disparaging comments about the characters of the women involved. Now, all of the parties have said that they really want to get on top of this issue of Westminster sleaze, sexual misconduct, and there has been hope that Keir Starmer and a Labour Party would be able to make more progress on that front than the Conservatives have managed. It's an issue for all parties. And I think there's a bit of really anxiety that she has been welcomed into the Labour Party with open arms without any conversation about that aspect of what she said and what it might mean if we wanted to clean up Westminster in future.
Why do you think she's done it? Because she's not standing at the next general election. We've got about 6 months left. Her views seem to be antithetical to Labour and Keir Starmer's platform. What's going through her head, Rachel? What do you think?
Well, she hasn't been offered... Labour says she hasn't been offered a peerage. Yeah. So that was the immediate thing. She crossed the floors to get a peerage. They say no. I think, I mean, George might, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts, but I think she may have been offered some kind of job, particularly on housing. Because the other thing she mentioned in her defection statement was Tory failure on house building and rental reform. And that's something that she is quite passionate about and that puts her more in the centre space than the right wing space. So do you think Keir Starmer would give her a housing job?
I'm sure there'll be conversations on advisory posts. I mean, I think it's similarly with Dan Poulter, who obviously defected a few weeks back on health. But I think if you're a would-be defector, there is an attractive political logic, which is that it's your moment to air your grievances and for the media to devote attention to your political views. If you're a backbench MP, it's relatively hard to get attention. You'll make speeches in Parliament, you'll write comment pieces here and there. Very rare that they'll actually really cut through and make headlines in the way a defection does. And so if you're a backbench MP, then it's similar to a minister resigning. You get to go out in a sort of blaze of glory. It's your moments in the spotlight. Some defections are different. Some are someone who's had a sort of ideological conversion and sees the party they defected as their new home, and they take a different direction in terms of their political career. If you're an MP who's standing down, as Natalie Elphick is, as Dan Poulter is, then it's almost more like a sort of howl of despair and an opportunity to have your hot take on where the government's going wrong.
Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to submit a question for us to discuss in a future podcast, you can do so at newstatesman.com/youaskus. If you're listening on Spotify, just scroll down on the episode page and type your reply. Or if you're watching on YouTube, you can leave a question in the comments. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Freddie Hayward, and my colleagues Rachel Cunliffe and George Eaton. We'll be back tomorrow to discuss the possibility of a new Tory leader. This episode was produced by Catherine Hughes. Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.